That line's U.S. House Speaker reiterates Washington's support for Taiwan, while Taipei says China's military drills in response to Nancy Pelosi's visit to the island breaches its territorial waters. China puts curbs on fruit and fish imports from Taiwan amid mounting tensions over Pelosi's visit to the island. And Russia warns it could use its nuclear arsenal in response to direct involvement of NATO countries over the Ukraine conflict. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Top story for this half hour, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has concluded her visit to Taiwan. There, she said Washington won't abandon its commitment to the self-ruled island.
Today, our delegation, which I'm very proud, came to Taiwan to make unequivocally clear we will not abandon our commitment to Taiwan, and we are proud of our enduring friendship.
Pelosi said the message of her trip is this: America's solidarity with Taiwan is crucial. She was speaking after talks with Taiwan's president. Tsai Ing-wen said the island will not back down in the face of military drills China has conducted in response to Pelosi's trip. Taiwan's defense ministry said the drills breached the island's waters. It called them an irrational move to challenge the international
today,
order.
Our delegation.
Beijing denounced Pelosi's visit immediately after she landed in Taipei on Tuesday evening.
The United States constantly distorts, obscures, and hollows out the One China principle. These moves, like playing with fire, are extremely dangerous. Those who play with fire will perish by it.
China has also vowed targeted military actions in response to Pelosi's visit. She was the highest-ranking American official to visit Taiwan in 25 years. Beijing considers the island as part of its territory and says it will one day join the motherland. China is strongly opposed to U.S. military and political support for Taiwan, saying it emboldens pro-independence forces there. In the wake of Pelosi's visit, China put curbs on fruit and fish imports from Taiwan while halting sand shipments to the island. We've talked to political commentator Said Mostafa Khushchishm about growing tensions between the U.S. and China over Taiwan. He believes the U.S. tries to bully all countries, including China, which it regards as enemies.
Americans deal with all their foes and rivals the same way. They try to bully and humiliate all those rivals and the states that are called as rogue states or enemy states, whatever they call. They try to humiliate and bully them. It doesn't make any difference if you're China, if you're Iran, if you're Russia. They try to impose their will on you, and be it in the negotiations over the war of tariff between the United States and China, or territorial integrity of China. It doesn't make any difference. The tactics they've been using against East European countries when they staged velvet revolutions were again repeated in Baghdad, embassy of the United States. The same was done in Hong Kong. And the same thing that they've been doing to all other enemies, they are now doing to China in Taiwan. It's not just the Biden administration or Nancy Pelosi. Under Donald Trump, the same strategy was underway, and they have continued the same kind of humiliation and the same kind of bullying tactics against Chinese.
China slammed the United States' actions in Taiwan as extremely dangerous. After U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi arrived on the island for a visit, the controversial visit has inflamed tensions between the superpowers. China says Taiwan is part of its territory. Watch this episode of Hashtag Trending for more on the topic.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another Hashtag Trending. Today we're talking about the rising tensions between China and the United States over House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. China has warned the U.S. that it is playing with fire over the issue. The Chinese military says it will launch targeted military operations in response to the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan amid soaring tensions. The visits by the U.S. House Speaker, who is third in line of succession to the presidency and a longtime critic of China, comes amid deteriorating relations between Beijing and Washington. Social media users have weighed in on the controversial topic. Let's see what they've had to say. Our first user, @Billy, has tweeted, China really outclassed the U.S. in a situation where a much harsher response was warranted. The U.S. once again showed that it's run by a petulant group of war-hungry pigs. Michael Tracy tweeted, after months of lectures about the supposedly sacrosanct nature of sovereignty and territorial integrity, those concepts are being thrown right back into the face of the U.S. Adrian Vermeul said, perhaps there are causes for which it is worth risking the destruction of humanity by apocalyptic fire, but Nancy Pelosi's travel schedule isn't one of them. Matilda wrote, the American propaganda machine spreads a lot of its propaganda, but the people of this globe, who has a clear mind and cannot be fooled by any kind of propaganda, can clearly see that the United Snakes is the one instigating a war with China. China has summoned the U.S. ambassador in Beijing to voice its strong protests at Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. China's foreign ministry described Pelosi's visit as egregious in nature and warned of extremely serious consequences. Now, some say that this visit was actually a sign of the United States' declining hegemony. Let's take a look at a few more comments. Danny Haifong said, China's response to Pelosi's Taiwan stunt teaches an important lesson. Just because you show your cards doesn't mean you gamble it away in a single move. China has economic and military advantages that U.S. interference cannot undermine. Time and history is on China's side. Jackson Hinkle tweeted, the U.S. is in the middle of a recession, inflation crisis, and cultural meltdown of degeneracy. Why are our leaders ignoring these issues and instead focused on starting wars with Russia over Ukraine and China over Taiwan? Send your responses to our socials to that question. Gabriel Liu said, Pelosi's Taiwan trip, nothing but political farce. And over here, another comment, Yon Snob said, if Russia, China, Iran, and the Central Asian states stick together, there is nothing the West will be able to do about it. Under the One China policy, nearly all countries across the globe, including the U.S., recognize Beijing's sovereignty over Chinese Taipei. But Washington courts the secessionist government in Taipei to harass China. Here's our final batch of tweets for the day. Tim Young tweeted, how many innocent people will die because Nancy Pelosi is flaunting her insider trading in Taiwan? Al Dance said, Nancy Pelosi is an outright criminal and should be thrown in jail. Also, all the Taiwanese officials who helped put this outrageous stunt together should pay a hefty price as well. I'm sure China is aware of who they are. Revolutionary Blackouts Network has our next tweet. Thank God for the restraint of China. China had every right to shoot that hag into the sea, but a war would destroy the global working class, and they acknowledge that. China constantly forced to be the adult in the room while the U.S. is run by psychopaths. Fabian has our final tweet of the day. The U.S. is slowly drowning in its contradictions. That's a wrap for another Hashtag Trending. Take care and bye-bye.
Well, Russia has accused NATO countries of what it calls a fierce hybrid confrontation against the country. That, Moscow says, dangerously balances on the edge of open military clash. Russia says it stands for preventing the clash, but it will not back down if the West tries to test Moscow's resolve. Those comments are made by a senior Russian foreign ministry official at the UN Nuclear Non-Proliferation Conference. Alexander Trofimov also said the conflict in Ukraine does not warrant Russia's use of nuclear weapons, but he added Moscow could use its nuclear arsenal in response to direct aggression by NATO. Meantime, the Russian Defense Ministry has accused the U.S. of direct involvement in the Ukraine war. The ministry has referred to comments by a Ukrainian official about the way Kiev had used Washington's HIMARS rocket system launchers based on real-time information. Iran's defense ministry has displayed its various products during an exhibition in Tehran titled The Defense Ministry's Capabilities in Cutting Capabilities in Knowledge-Based Production and Economy. Salman Kudri reports on that.
Iran's defense ministry has held an exhibition on its capabilities in knowledge-based production and economy.
The event covers such fields as transportation, health and medical equipment, security, energy, information and communication technology, cyberspace, construction and mining, industry, petrochemicals, food security and agriculture, as well as household appliances, electronic parts and geographic data and information. In general, 1,100 products in various fields have been put on display at the exhibition. Iran has repeatedly voiced its readiness to provide advanced scientific and military technologies to friendly and neighboring states, because it has already achieved self-sufficiency and scientific capabilities in the field of military power and manufacturing state-of-the-art weaponry.
Holding such exhibitions will provide an opportunity to learn more about the potential and capacities of the private, knowledge-based companies and make use of their potentials for defense-related productions.
Meanwhile, Iran's defense minister has announced that in the coming days, his ministry would unveil a series of new defensive achievements.
According to Iranian officials, as a result of cooperation between Iran's defense ministry and knowledge-based companies, the capacity of the ministry for production has increased by over 20 times in the past couple of years. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Well, the United States is calling for Argentina to seize a Venezuelan cargo plane grounded in Buenos Aires since June. The U.S. Justice Department says the plane has been sold by Iran's Mahan Air to Venezuela's Emtrasur company. The department says that's in violation of U.S. export control laws because both airlines are under sanction. The plane has been stuck in Argentina since June 8th. That's when it tried to fly to Uruguay but was denied entry. On Monday, Argentina's federal judge ordered the departure of a dozen of 19 crew members who include Iranians and Venezuelans. Last week, Iran summoned Argentina's envoy calling for the departure of its nationals. Tehran says Iranian trainers are on board the plane in accordance with international aviation regulations. Well, the leader of Hezbollah resistance, who has slammed U.S.'s empty promises for the transfer of natural gas and electricity from Egypt and Jordan to Lebanon. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said 1 year has passed since the U.S. ambassador's promise, but nothing has happened in practice. He added that the movement had proposed to buy fuel from Iran to meet Lebanon's energy needs, but the U.S. did not allow it to happen. Nasrallah said the United States and Israel are the embodiment of the devil, and Hezbollah's struggle against them will continue. Nasrallah's remarks came 2 days after he issued a stern warning to Israel about exploiting Lebanon's offshore energy resources. Nasrallah said the resistance movement is ready for any scenario, including a war, to protect those resources. The dispute between Lebanon and Israel escalated in early June after the regime sent a drilling ship to the Karish gas field in the Mediterranean. Lebanon dismisses Israel's claim that the field falls within its so-called exclusive economic zone. Mariam Saleh in Beirut explains why the Hezbollah leader is raising the issue of Washington's failure to fulfill its promises towards Lebanon.
What we're seeing right now is the worst crisis of all, where we don't have any fuel coming into Lebanon. There are weeks where people have absolutely no electricity. When there is fuel, people can witness maybe an hour or two of electricity. So this is what we're talking about, a really major crisis. And that was the case even more after the economic fallout here in Lebanon. At that time, Hezbollah had vowed that they would bring in diesel from Iran, and they did, and those were all donations to Lebanon. They were sold to some hospitals, but they were also donated to orphanages and so on. That solved the crisis for quite a while. However, after that promise by Hezbollah, after that implementation, we had also another promise from the U.S. ambassador, and up until now, we have not seen anything. We know that the Egyptians are ready to send the gas. We know the Jordanians are ready. The Syrians are ready. They've even made the maintenance necessary for their pipelines to bring in gas to Lebanon in order for Lebanon to witness more hours of electricity. However, up until now, we know from the Egyptians and the Jordanians that the U.S. has not given Lebanon the exception from the Caesar Act. This is because our gas needs to go through Syria. So Sayed Nasrallah is trying to show that the U.S. has only made empty promises so far, and nothing has been done in that regard. And he's mainly calling out on those who consider themselves friends of the U.S. or allies of the U.S. here in Lebanon, who continue to criticize any assistance that comes from the Islamic Republic of Iran and any assistance that is being done by Hezbollah.
The Afghan capital witnessed several strong explosions on Sunday morning. Now the U.S. president says he recently ordered a precision airstrike on an al-Qaeda safe house in Kabul. Joe Biden says al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri was killed in the drone attack on Sunday. We have more in this following report.
Several explosions rocked the northern neighborhood of Wazir Akbar Khan in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The U.S. claims the CIA successfully targeted the safe house there, killing al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri. The pressure is again on people, as unfortunately, it has become very common to wake up to the sound of explosions every morning. At first, the Taliban claimed that the explosions were caused by blind rockets. Now that the drone strike has been confirmed, the Taliban condemn it and consider it a violation of Afghan sovereignty and the Doha Agreement signed between them and the U.S. They also stressed that the targeted house was empty during the raid and that there were no casualties. The recent airstrike in Kabul has now stoked fears among people. They are scared that such incidents might happen more and more frequently, as they witnessed 10 members of a family, including 6 children, were targeted a year ago in a drone strike before the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. The Afghan people are most shocked by what happened. They say their land has become a hotspot for settling international accounts they have nothing to do with. But, as always, they have to bear the brunt of such incidents. Abdullah Amirzadeh from Kabul.
The Election Commission of Pakistan has ruled that the party of former Prime Minister Imran Khan has received funds from prohibited sources, including foreign nationals and foreign companies. The ruling could put the former international cricket star turned politician in further trouble after he was ousted from power in April in a vote of no confidence. Kamran Yusuf has the details.
It took the Election Commission of Pakistan 7 years to conclude the illegal funding case against the party of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The case that was filed by one of the founding members of Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party maintained that his party received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities. In a 70-page judgment, the Election Commission confirmed that Tehreek-e-Insaf was guilty and concealed 16 bank accounts through which it accepted donations from foreigners or foreign groups. The Election Commission also ruled that the former Prime Minister submitted false statements regarding his party's funding, but the party of Imran Khan has dismissed the charges. The ruling comes over 3 months after Khan lost his office in a vote of no confidence in April. But Khan still insists he was ousted from power through a US-backed conspiracy. Despite being ousted from power, Khan's popularity has increased. This was reflected in by-elections held recently in Punjab, where Khan's party swept the polls. The unexpected victory by Khan's party has allowed them to regain control of Punjab province.
There is no immediate fallout of the Election Commission's ruling on Khan and his party. Nevertheless, findings of the Election Commission may lead to legal challenges for the former Prime Minister. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the text of the speech delivered on June the 28th, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of the top officials and employees of the judiciary. Sometimes in some places, whether they are in the judiciary, the executive branch, or elsewhere, there are some structures that naturally bring corruption. Those structures must be eliminated. Look for those structures, find them, and get rid of them. This is the second point. The third recommendation is about strengthening judicial knowledge. Judicial knowledge needs to be increased. Some of these rulings are either weak or distorted. Sometimes by chance, according to a report or something. We have heard of certain rulings like this. If you look at these, some of these rulings are very weak. For example, the 10 arguments that a judge presents for making a decision. At times, most of the arguments that have been presented are flawed and weak.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Arguments must be convincing, they must be strong. Even in the prosecutor's office, not just in the court, the reasons presented by the prosecutor in an indictment must be convincing reasons and he should be able to defend these reasons. This does not mean that whatever the prosecutor says will automatically be accepted, but his reasons must be logical and defensible. In the case of the judge and the court, this is much more important. This is what I wanted to say about the topic of having enough scientific judicial knowledge, both with regard to cases and about decrees. So, it is necessary for judicial knowledge to increase. The fourth issue is the issue of encouragement and punishment within the judiciary. We've already talked about punitive and corrective measures. They, judges, staff, should be encouraged too. You see, there truly are some. One can see this. Although we are informed from far, And we know that they truly struggle. They really work in some cases. They even take their breaks to look into legal matters. Well, these examples should be identified. And such cases should be encouraged with all kinds of encouragements. When I say encouragement, this does not just mean monetary encouragement. There is encouragement for the person's reputation. There is encouragement for introducing these people and other such encouragements. These people should be encouraged, and this is the next point.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The war in Yemen has killed thousands of people and left a large portion of the population on the verge of starvation. But 2 months ago, a spark of hope was reignited among the Yemenis. The Saudi-backed coalition and the Ansarullah resistance movement announced an extension to the 2-month truce, which was agreed upon in April. But now, the same hope has transformed into fear and anxiety for the civilians as the war-ravaged country awaits two scenarios: a new cycle of war or an extended cessation of conflict. The United Nations-sponsored truce has been the longest respite Yemen has seen during the war. But even though the truce lasted, despite multiple violations from the Saudi side, there have been no reports of an extension. As the expiration approached, the UN ramped up its efforts to renew the agreement, which it says has resulted in improved humanitarian conditions and has led to a significant decrease in civilian casualties. The truce brought immense relief to civilians, but its true potential regarding effectiveness and longevity remain under question. One issue that persists is Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement being dissatisfied with its implementation, saying the Saudi-led coalition has not fulfilled its obligations. Experts have also criticized the truce for failing to address the main and underlying issues behind the war.
Well, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudis, who did block shipments and engaged in a couple of skirmishes, but it was still much better than the previous state of affairs. And that currently it seems to be expiring without serious action to make it permanent, presumably mainly because, the Saudis are not willing to let go of this stranglehold they've got right now on Yemen, and they're not willing to let go of their hopes for establishing a puppet regime and getting control of this geostrategically crucial area. And the West has apparently decided to let them.
Saudi Arabia launched its war on Yemen with the objective of installing a Riyadh-friendly regime and crushing the Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement. But while the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its goals, the war has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The ongoing war on Yemeni people has also sparked global outrage over grim violations of human rights. The United Nations Committee Against Torture has voiced concern over the torture and ill-treatment of Yemenis by the United Arab Emirates, armed forces, state security agencies, and on-state armed groups. Earlier this year, the UN expressed concern regarding the civilian casualties in Yemen. Many rights organizations have also condemned the acts of aggression against the Yemenis, especially children and women, and denounced the continued international silence on the crimes. But the June ceasefire, especially its extension in April, raised the prospects of peace in a country that has only faced destruction and gloom over the past years.
Well, it would be nice if a habit of peace had been established so that the hot war doesn't break out again right away. But again, this truce was not fully respected by the Saudi side. And the fact that they haven't been able to extend it is a bad sign. It suggests that the Saudis are unwilling to essentially admit that they made a mistake when they entered this war, and that they can't gain control over Yemen. And that admission would require a big change in policy, and right now they're not under enough pressure to do it. The oil prices have gone up. The Saudis are doing okay financially. They apparently are under no pressure whatsoever from the Biden administration to roll back or extend the truce or negotiate a lasting peace. So I don't see any indication, unfortunately, that the truce will continue.
Yemeni officials have, however, expressed their doubt over a third extension of the ceasefire. They say the UN has failed to bring the much-needed breathing room for civilians. Another matter which seems to be behind the Yemenis' doubt is the Saudi-led coalition refusing to fully commit to the terms of the truce, including halting its attacks. Natural gas is one of several commodities massively impacted by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The European Union receives about 40% of its natural gas from Russian pipelines, about a quarter of which flow through Ukraine. And now, in light of sanctions raised against Moscow and the months-long war, energy truly seems to be at the front and center of the conflict. Natural gas prices reached record highs in October 2021, and prices have kept climbing since hitting a new all-time high in March. Prices on the Dutch TTF hub, a European benchmark for natural gas trading, more than tripled between February 16 and March 7 before pulling back. Russia has been accused of using its natural gas as an economic and political bargaining chip. But despite all this, natural gas has continued to flow to Europe, except for a few extreme cases. An example of this would be Germany accusing Moscow of engaging in power play over energy exports. This as Germany, which imports 40% of its gas from Russia, sanctioned Moscow and is now facing record inflation in light of surging prices. Now Latvia has joined Poland, Bulgaria, Finland, Netherlands, and Denmark in being cut off from Russian gas. Gazprom says it has halted gas supplies to Riga in light of their violation of supply conditions. While Russia did not specify the violations, it had already cut off gas supplies to the other countries for refusing to pay in ruble. Riga had already decided to ban Russian gas imports from January 2023, and last week it even said it was not buying Russian gas from Gazprom. And on Saturday, Latvia said that Gazprom's decision would have little effect on the country. But while many European countries have expressed similar remarks in light of Russia's bans and rises in energy prices, their decisions seem to be going against their national interests, mainly as they have made such remarks while failing to find alternatives to cheap Russian gas. So what seems to be the case is a political decision at the expense of the people who have thus far incurred the unbearable rising costs of living.
Well, no. There is a very high-stakes game of geopolitical poker going on here, and Europe does need Russian gas. At the same time, these countries, many of them, I mean Latvia, Poland, Bulgaria, are in the forefront, Poland, in the forefront of countries that want to defeat Russia, basically. I mean, they believe they have the moral high ground, that they have a good cause, but they really want to stick it to Russia. That is their goal.
Russia is the largest exporter of natural gas globally and the second largest producer behind the US. For decades, Russian natural gas has powered European homes and industries. In 1968, Austria and the Soviet Union signed a gas deal, and in the early 70s, natural gas shipments began arriving in West Germany. But in 1981, CIA intelligence assessment of a proposed 3,000-mile-long natural gas pipeline from Siberia to Western Germany warned of a trouble ahead. It said the pipeline would be a reliable source of gas for the continent, but would also give the Soviets political leverage over Europe. Now those problems are ringing true, but only since EU and the US have sanctioned Russia, leaving Russia with no choice but to exert energy pressure on Europe. As Russia tightens its chokehold on supplies of natural gas, Europe is looking everywhere for alternatives. Coal is back on the table and deals are being struck with new partners. Despite all this, fears are growing across the continent that a Russian gas cutoff will force governments to ration fuel, risking both jobs and people's lives. Now the race to find alternatives to Russian gas has accelerated, but the question remains as to what happens if the economies tank badly, as they seem to be, and no alternatives are found. Will the EU unity against Russia fall apart?
I do not know the answer to that. Certainly, this puts great stress on European unity. In the long term, there are alternatives to Russian energy. Although Russia, you know, it's attached to Europe, it's part of the greater Eurasia region, and it is a source of not just gas and oil, but many, many other raw materials, which are now being cut off, and Europe and Russia are having a really painful divorce, and it's the Europeans' governments mean for Russia to suffer the pain, but in fact, in a form of blowback, they are suffering it too.
Indications that such unity is bound to fall apart are already emerging. Some EU leaders are already calling for a reconsideration in the bloc strategies. Some have even labeled Europe's attempts of replacing Russian gas as being on a knife on edge. But despite the heavy costs incurred by Europeans, the bloc's leaders seem to have set their eyes on continuing their way, and experts say their problems may only worsen in the future.
The U.S. economy has entered a recession. Based on the official definition of the recession, when the economy contracts for two consecutive quarters, that is the definition of a recession. Recession fears for the U.S. have been ongoing for some time. One of the factors which speeded up the decline of the economy was energy prices, which have affected the prices of goods, from food to basic stuff, leading to inflation. The U.S. is experiencing over 9% inflation, something it has not experienced in over four decades.
The American economy is being bashed from pillar to post right now by a whole range of factors, but certainly it's going into recession because there's severe headwinds being caused by, first of all, the government cutting back on its spending in a ridiculous attempt to balance its budget, which it should not be trying to do in the first place, and then high interest rates compared to what they have been in the recent past, even though they're below the rate of inflation, and meaning that households are no longer borrowing, and in fact they're probably paying their level of debt down.
The U.S. president has been trying to portray this as a temporary phase, which the U.S. economy will overcome.
We're not going to be in a recession, in my view. The employment rate is still one of the lowest we've had in history. It's in the 3.6 area. We still find ourselves with people investing. My hope is we go from this rapid growth to steady growth.
But as things are going, especially the war in Ukraine, this is anything but temporary. The mayor of New York has painted an even bleaker picture. He has said that we are in a financial crisis like you can never imagine. Wall Street is collapsing. We are in a recession. poor state of the U.S. economy is typical to many economies around the world, especially the ones in Europe. One of the telltale signs is the price of energy, which has affected Europe so badly that economies in countries like Germany, the U.K., France, and Italy are all experiencing GDP contractions or slow economic growth. The Ukraine conflict is definitely one factor weighing down on the economies, but it would be wrong to blame the negative economic performance just on the war itself.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job, because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game. And I don't think the administration's really put it as a very high priority.
Consumers are being bashed by inflation running about 5% per year higher than wage rises. Now, in that situation, consumers are likely to be trying to do everything they can not to spend.
The U.S., similar to Germany, is carrying a deficit. That is when companies import more and export less, dynamic that weighs down on the GDP. Yet, the future looks bleak. As economies are still facing the COVID pandemic, with supply chains not fully recovered, the U.S. is pursuing an aggressive policy towards China, which involves a trade war. Europe is bound to follow the U.S. lead, which can only make matters worse for their economies.
The United States has given the green light to more arms sales to East Asian nations in a bid to counter China. The package of arms and munitions, which is worth $900 million, has been approved by the State Department and is set to be sold to Australia, Japan, and Singapore. A potential deal with Australia includes 80 Lockheed Martin precision-guided air-to-surface missiles and associated equipment. The deal, which is set to be worth $235 million, will allow Australian jets to stay outside the range of the opponent's air defense units while launching attacks. Back in April, Canberra approved that $2.44 billion US dollars worth of, quote, improved weapon capabilities be quickly delivered to the country from the US. Australian officials claim they need the equipment to meet the country's increasingly complex and challenging strategic environment. The package for Japan would include 150 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles. The missiles, which are to be installed on the country's F-35 fighter jets, are worth more than $290 million. Singapore will receive $630 million to supply its fighter jets with air-to-air missiles. Australia, Japan, and Singapore are considered U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific region against what Washington describes as the rising threat from China.
Yeah, this one, these sales of weapons to Japan and Singapore basically came after a speech of General Milley, where he complained about the aggression, the posture of the Chinese military, especially the pilot, when they intercept any aircraft from the United States or from their ally. So they said that they wanted to give weapons to be effective against possible interception of aircraft.
The sales of advanced weapons to U.S. allies in the region come amid rising rivalries between the United States and China. Washington is pursuing a policy of cooperation and coordination with regional countries against China. It aims to push these countries to contribute more to joint regional military programs. It's now believed that the United States, which has been the preeminent military power in that region for decades, can no longer guarantee by itself a regional balance of power. Global geopolitics is changing, contrary to the expectations and demands of politicians in Washington. It's now an open secret that China is a rising military and economic powerhouse in the East Asia region.
With major advances in missile technology, naval forces and intelligence, China is well on its way to becoming world-class military power. It has already surpassed Washington in several areas. And apart from that, China has massive economic ties with the regional countries.
With the exception of four countries that are already, for historical reason, very much linked to the United States from a military point of view, it means South Korea, Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. All of the other countries here are quite difficult that they can enter in a kind of alliance, a military alliance, as the NATO in Europe. There are many reasons. There are political reasons, but also economic reasons, because China is growing so fast, and their economy, the economy of these countries, are very much interconnected with the China one.
China is concerned about the belligerent rhetoric coming from the U.S. Beijing and Washington have been at odds over several issues in recent years, including trade and the South China Sea. But Beijing's ultimate concern is Washington's meddling in Chinese Taipei. China has made it clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to secede. It has already strongly warned against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the dispute over the strategic island may prove to be a real challenge between the two superpowers in the coming years.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. We express our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
شهادت امام حسین کاری با دلها کرده و تأثیری رو دلها گذاشته که برای بقیه نیست.
The martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam breaks so many hearts and influences many people across the world more than any other occasion. Compared with other religious occasions during the year, ceremonies held for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam makes us shed more tears and prepare our hearts for spiritual development. Even when mourning ceremonies are held for other infallibles, at the end of the ceremony, Imam al-Hussein's martyrdom and his afflictions are remembered and make the people shed tears. Abu Abdullah al-Hussein's influence on the hearts is different from the other infallibles.
Karbala! As I step onto your sands, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been placed here beneath your sky.
یه کتابی هست رفقایی که اهل مطالعه اید.
There is a famous book by the title of Kamal al-Ziyarat. I really invite all Muslims, brothers and sisters, to read this book. The main content of this book is about Ziyarah and the text of Ziyarah, which is really precious. This book is among the Shiite legacy. This book is about 500 pages, 400 of which is about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. The number of the narrations and statements about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is much higher than the infallibles. This shows the great status of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam even in the eyes of other infallibles.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura,
thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We again express our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his faithful companions in the month of Muharram. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
The seasons, tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Karbala, what precious blood was spilled there.
The story of Mas'ud and Saddam.
Part 2.
Upon his arrival in Iraq in 1986, Mas'ud Rajavi was received warmly by the ruling Ba'ath Party. It was at this point that Saddam Hussein and Mas'ud Rajavi started a lifelong friendship, one that heralded a new chapter for the Iraqi people. At the time, no one could even imagine that the presence of a terrorist organization headed by Mas'ud Rajavi would have such disastrous consequences for the Iraqi citizens. shoring up Rajavi's fragile group and providing him with military facilities to establish a small but independent army on Iraqi soil. Saddam Hussein was in fact helping Rajavi fulfill his dream of becoming the president of Iran. But Rajavi's assault to take Tehran was a non-starter. His army was dealt heavy losses in what Iran called Operation Mersad. This was the last major military operation of the Iran-Iraq War, ending in a decisive victory for Iran. Unable to take Tehran, the defeated army had to remain in Iraq, an albatross around the neck of the Ba'ath Party. As the Iraqi war in Iran drew to an end with no significant achievement for the Iraqi strongmen, signs of despair and distrust began to bubble up in the rank and file of the Ba'ath army, bringing the country to the verge of a revolt against Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. But the dictator's scheme saved his power. At Saddam Hussein's order, the Ba'ath military camps received Rajavi's group between 1988 and 1991. The aim was to give the MKO members special military training with modern weapons. At the time, no one knew when and where the training and the weapons would be used. Not only did the Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization resemble the Ba'ath Party in appearance, also efforts were made to inculcate into the members the idea that ordinary people would be enemy number one for them. On August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. He wanted to compensate for heavy losses he had incurred in his 8-year-old war on Iran, and also to find a way out for the country's deteriorating economy. But the dictator made miscalculations. All his once Western and Arab supporters stood against him. He was doomed to defeat in this war as well. On March 3, 1991, one day after the Persian Gulf War ceasefire, a T-72 tank gunner, returning home after Iraq's defeat in Kuwait, fired a shell into a colossal portrait of Saddam Hussein hanging over Basra's main square. The revolt in Basra was first led by Colonel Mohammad Ibrahim Wali, an Iraqi army officer. He attacked some government buildings and prisons in the city. Backed by a majority of the population, the uprising led to the fall of Basra into the hands of the dissidents. On the same day, in Najaf, a demonstration near Imam Ali Mosque became a gun battle between army deserters and Saddam's security forces. People seized control of the city. The uprising spread within days to all of the big Shia cities in South Iraq. Amara, Diwaniya, Hilla, Karbala, Kut, Nasiriyah, and Samawa. Now, the initial protests had turned into a widespread uprising in which both Shia and Sunni Muslims stood side by side against the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. 3 days after the start of the uprising in the south, which was also referred to as the Shaban Intifada due to its concurrent